Coming to you from the customs office just outside El Dorado. Yes, that El Dorado. It's the Liberal Arts.
A podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
Hi everyone, I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa.
And I have a fun fact for you guys.
Oh good.
Is it that you're falling asleep actively?
Again?
You know, it could be, but it's not.
Okay, good.
It involves crustaceans, a 12th century battle, a child emperor, and ghosts.
This is amazing. Okay. I love how your fun facts come with teaser trailers.
Thank you.
I feel like this could be a whole colloquium right here.
So, the year is 1185. We are in Japan, okay?
Oh, no.
In the Dan no Ura Bay of Japan's Inland Sea. There's a battle brewing, and on the one side there is a child emperor and his clan, who are later... At the time, they were called the Terra, but then now they're called the... Time for another edition of Hannah Pronounces Japanese Poorly. Hike, I think.
How do you spell that?
H-E-I-K-E. Hike. Hike. Sure. On the other side are the Genji. Now,
Genji!
The Hike...
I'm sorry, I had to... I Overwatch. Bye!
Get out, you Overwatch nerd. Now, the Hike are led by the child emperor Antoku, who is basically led by his grandmother.
Nice.
The other side is led by a great general whose name is...
Genji.
Nope.
Hanzo.
Nope. Do you got any other words?
Shimada?
Any other... No, okay, no.
I need healing. Shut up. Sorry.
Wow. His name was Minotaro Yoritomo.
That's such a better name.
Yeah, it is really.
That was such a bad pronunciation.
Stan. Yeah, I know. I am not... I don't have enough sleep to try again. So, we have this great battle.
Hannah is, like, just running down on battery TikTok.
I really am. Let me get my fun fact out before I die. The Hike are losing badly until it gets to the point where it looks like the child emperor is going to be... captured. So his grandmother takes him and both of them jump into the sea, and his samurai see him do this, and out of respect for him and to avoid capture, they also jump into the sea.
Wow.
And that was the end of emperors being the main leaders in Japan. At that point it went to like a shogunate system, and the first shogun was Minamoto Yoritomo, who was that general. Now, what's curious is that in the bay where this battle took place, in the bay of Dan no Ura, there is a kind of crab. And there's something about this crab that's very strange, because if you look at the bottom of this crab, the muscular structure underneath his legs, it looks like a samurai mask.
Huh.
Yeah, so the legend goes that the crabs are the reincarnated spirits of the Hiike samurai who plunged to their death out of respect for their emperor. And these crabs are called samurai crabs, or Hiike Gani. Gani. Nope. Hiike Gani. Sure.
I love it.
Yeah.
I like
that. I mean, it was a story about a child committing suicide, but it was a good one?
Well, you know, he was like six, so I don't think it was a suicide so much as it was a murder. But yeah.
Is there even a word for killing of an emperor? Because regicide is the king.
I think it would probably be the same. It's like the same concept.
Impericide?
Impericide.
I don't know. Is there a word for killing your grandson?
Infanticide.
He's six.
Miho.
That's a baby.
Miho side. I don't know. We should,
Wow, that's bad.
So, what's our colloquium today, Rissa?
Yeah, for my next few colloquiums, I'm going to be talking about mythology. I mentioned this in our What We're Into episode, and one of our listeners, JD, messaged us and said that I should definitely do this. So here you go, JD. This is for you. It's actually for me, but I'm very glad that you're going to enjoy it.
Yay!
Primarily, I'll be talking about Greek mythology, but hopefully we'll get into Norse eventually. I might touch on some others if I have time to research them, but I'm going to admit right now that Greek and Norse are really the only two I have knowledge of. There's a lot of really cool mythologies in this world from all sorts of places that we just don't hear enough about, but unfortunately, I also don't know enough about them to lecture, so... but first, this first colloquium is going to be a bit different. I wanted to start, as always, with talking about why I chose my topic, why I love mythology and want to talk about it. And I ended up writing so much on that section, it really ended up a whole colloquium on just that. So that's what we're going to do today.
Yay!
Awesome.
So some of this is going to be personal, of course, but I really want to pitch this one, this colloquium, as a sort of my philosophy of mythology and of storytelling as a whole. We're going to get into some stuff that is honestly pretty foundational to the way I see the world, which is rather fitting for the subject matter. So next time we're going to talk about Greek myths, and I'll do my best to regale you with all the stories I can remember about the gods and nymphs and titans and all that. But for now, we're going to talk about what a myth is.
It's the opposite of a mister.
Oh my god. Science doesn't get to answer anymore. Nestor?
Okay.
What would you define a myth as?
Well,
on the spot,
I think
go.
I would define a myth as kind of... I guess more of a story that gives you the background of a culture, where they think they're from, and what they think is important.
Okay.
Whether they actually believe that the story has happened in that exact way or not. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But just where did we come from? How did we get to where we are? And what kind of things are important to us out of those stories?
Okay, yeah. I think that's a good working definition. You've kind of... not said much on what the content of the myth is, but more what we can tell from myths, which I think is an interesting perspective because it necessarily means you're looking back. There, it might be the case that people who invented these myths thought of them the same way, that we teach our children what's important by teaching these, but it's not necessary that they thought of them that way. So I think that's a really interesting definition. But yeah, a myth is a story, generally about the gods and heroes of old. Myths tend to be things that everyone believes happened a very long time ago. Myths often explain why the world is the way that it is, and sometimes also give accounts of the afterlife or what will happen in the future. But I want to start with the basics, something that you also mentioned. A myth is a story, and that in itself makes it very important. So I want to talk about why are stories important? It's one of the questions that I've tried and pretty much failed to approach in my academic writing, but I thought this might be a better medium for the discussion. I think there's lots of ways in which stories are important, but I want to try to build kind of my own philosophical framework for my account of one reason why stories are so foundational to us as human beings, which I think is really what mythology brings out, that stories are foundational. So it probably won't surprise you guys that to talk about mythology, I'm going to have to talk about philosophy first.
What a nerd.
Yeah. The two actually operate in some similar fields. Both philosophy and mythology are attempts to explain the deeper nature of the world.
They're also like
yeah?
ways to tell people who they are.
Yeah. Yeah. So the deeper nature of the world, the deeper nature of human beings, they're often concerned with gods and ethics, the proper way of living life, what they're concerned with, what's important, that kind of thing. So there actually is some commonality here. But these two approach the same topic at basically opposite angles. Totally different strategies to get to the same types of answers. They actually do generate something similar in some regards, and that's really what I want to look at. So I've described philosophy before on this podcast as being about 80% all about defining your terms. Most of what philosophers do is argue about how you define a term. things like knowledge. Epistemology is the field of philosophy that just debates the term, what do you mean when you say knowledge or know, or things like that. And one of the main goals of philosophy is to construct a framework and a vocabulary with which to discuss the world, especially its non-physical nature. Philosophy is therefore largely about vocabulary generation, and a lot of things are. Science is vocabulary generation to an extent. When you discover something new, you get to name it. And then you can point out that thing as distinct from the other things because it has a name. The more things we can point to and identify and place in context with each other, the more things we can discuss and discover. So, and this can have some real-world effects. One of the probably best examples from philosophy defining terms having real-world effects is in ethics. Sexual harassment. Sexual harassment has always existed, but it's only been rather recently that people have started calling it out. And philosophers have argued that the reason for this, or one of the reasons for this, I should say, is that people didn't have a name for it. They didn't know that this was a thing that could be named. And that sounds weird. It's not like people didn't see it, but people didn't identify it as sexual harassment. They didn't identify it as something that could be called out. It was just a part of life. That's just what happened. But as soon as someone pointed to that thing and named it, then victims could look at their situation and say, oh, that's what's happening to me. Mm. So the ability to express, the ability to have words to understand your own situation is very important. And that's really what a lot of philosophy, especially applied philosophy like ethics, does. A large part of my own dissertation was spent trying to develop new vocabulary with which to discuss video games. And it's not the part of the essay that everyone else found exciting because it wasn't an argument. But it, for me, it was the most important part of the topic because even if my argument was wrong, at least I had developed this vocabulary so that other people could talk about the things that I was seeing that no one else had pointed out and named yet.
It also is nice because it makes sure that if you are having a discussion with someone, if you are at odds with someone, that you know that you're talking about the same thing.
Exactly. And that's really what a lot of this comes down to. Okay, but what does all this have to do with mythology? So philosophy generates vocabulary. It gives us the words with which to point out the truth. I want to argue that mythology is also, in a way, about vocabulary generation, but a really different sort of vocabulary. Philosophy generates words. Mythology generates pictures.
Huh.
Now, it's still a form, a kind of vocabulary. It sounds weird to use vocabulary, because that sounds like, you know, vocal vocabulary. But it's still a language, I should say. It's a language of images that mythology generates. And really, storytelling generates. So basically, I'm going to step back from mythology for a second, look at storytelling. Why are stories important? And I want to do some of what I just said philosophy does. I'm going to lay a framework. I'm going to pitch to you my theory about how the world works. I think of it like this. There are two types of learning that we need, for lack of a better word. Two types of learning. Like I said, knowledge is a really touchy subject in philosophy. So there's what I call knowledge and what I call understanding. Now, I'm not the only person to use those two words, but the way I use them, you could call them head knowledge and heart knowledge is a good term. Head knowledge is the type of thing we learn from books, philosophy books, things like that. The facts of matter, the words, the logos, if you will, is head knowledge. It's rather easy to acquire logos, at least in principle. It normally involves reading books and talking to experts and checking the facts. That's the kind of stuff that you learn from logos. But understanding or heart knowledge is something different. It's a lot harder to acquire because its best teacher is firsthand experience. It's a lot harder to talk about because it you cannot learn it from words.
Rissa, this entire thing is what my friend Brittany has been doing her thesis on.
Yeah, I've tried to write on this too. It's very difficult.
Yeah.
But yeah, okay, so understanding. I said it was hard to acquire, but what is it? To understand something is to not just know the words, but know what they mean. Know what they feel like, taste like, smell like. There is pathos attached to the logos now. One of the best examples of this might be love. I know that my mother loves me because she says so. Say I'm a child and I'm learning what the word love means, and I hear my mother tell me she loves me. So I know that whatever it is that love is, it's that thing which my mother has for me. But I only understand that my mother loves me because she acts like it, and I experience that love. And that, in turn, helps me shape my understanding of what love means, what it feels like, what it looks like. Love is something like what my mother has for me, and it feels like what my mother has for me, that kind of stuff. This is understanding based on firsthand experience. Now, the thing is, understanding based on firsthand experience like this can vary greatly from person to person. Your relationship with your mother is doubtlessly different than mine. And if someone, for example, had a mother who said I loved you, but then never acted like it, that could really mess up your understanding of what love means, what it feels like, even if it doesn't change your head knowledge of what love is. Does that make sense?
Yay, trauma.
Yeah. So understanding is, to borrow a phrase from C.S. Lewis, is the way that knowledge is incarnated to us. Knowledge made flesh, if you will. If it's not too blasphemous to say, logos sarx egentheo, the word become flesh. And it's very important. Because it's based on experience, understanding is super hard to discuss, it can be very personal, and it is extremely hard to teach or transfer to others. Transferring knowledge, head knowledge, is really easy. You write it down in a book. You write a textbook, you can transmit a lot of knowledge very efficiently, and people can have that knowledge for years and years and years. But understanding can be super hard, which is the reason that when we can, we educate people both through reading and experience. In a high school chemistry course, we don't just read chemistry textbooks, we do chemistry experiments in a lab. Not because we need to test a new theory and we don't know what will happen, it says right there in the book what's supposed to happen, but because we, as students, need to experience it ourselves. But for things that aren't science and aren't experiments like that, it can be really hard to teach someone how to have an experience that will lead to understanding. There are different ways to do this. Some, like self-help books, kind of use this type of model, but luckily, In my theory, there is a way to indirectly transfer experiences, or even generate them for other people. So this would be really useful, right? If you could generate an experience for someone, or transfer your experience to someone else, and transfer understanding. This happens That's a lot right. in fantasy. It's kind of the ability to mind meld, that type of thing.
Yes.
So the way I see it, this is exactly what storytelling can do. Storytelling steps in this gap and creates an experience which can help transfer and shape the understanding of others, so we can pass it along.
Hey, Rissa.
Yes.
I love that.
I know. I told you you would.
I do!
So all stories are capable of transmitting understanding, but some of them are more geared towards it than others, and some of it do a much better job than others. But the stories we interact with, all of them, but especially the ones we really invest ourselves in, shape our understanding of things in a similar fashion to our own firsthand experience. And the stories we tell help us to transfer our understanding of things to other people, which I believe is something that we as humans have a natural drive and need to do.
Yes.
Yeah. Stories allow us to share experiences by proxy in a way, not only between the storyteller and the audience, but all of the audience members together. Everyone who hears this story has just shared an experience. And if we all share the same stories, then all of our understanding of a certain thing are going to be shaped in a similar way, not identically, but in a similar fashion. We have the same influences shaping us, to the point where it can become a language of its own, a language that reaches past knowledge and logos and directly touches understanding and pathos, a language of images.
Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra.
Okay. Yay! Star Trek. No, don't apologize. I love you. What I really like about this is that it makes an argument for why representation is important.
Yes.
Because if you cannot see how an experience relates to you, then it's harder to understand the experience that is trying to be conveyed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh man. So if you do see yourself in a story, if you do see yourself or something like yourself, an experience that can easily be translated to your brain,
mm-hmm.
given who you think you are, then it makes it that much easier to, like, incorporate the experience.
Yes,
I feel like
it
I'm traveling
does.
In circles. Does that
no,
make
no,
sense?
No, no, no. I think you're right, because if you see something that is always associated, even incidentally, with something that you identify as not me, it can shape your understanding of that thing. When I was younger, my understanding of heroism was tied to masculinity. And it took me a really long time to break that down and say those two are not intrinsically tied, because my understanding was shaped by the stories that I lived in. And also, when you do see something that you identify with yourself, it can help you shape your understanding of yourself in a really quite unique way. Yeah, so I think you're right. The really interesting thing about all this, from a philosophy point of view, is that these stories do not have to be true in order to do this. They do not have to transfer knowledge at all. And we don't have to believe them to be true either. I don't have to believe that Narnia and Aslan exist for them to profoundly shape my understanding of God. They don't give me any knowledge of God whatsoever. They don't claim to. That comes from somewhere else. But they can shape my understanding.
Ooh, I love this.
Mm-hmm. I told you you would. Like, three times. So because of all this, the stories we listen to, and when I say listen to, I mean, like, really pay attention to, the ones we allow into our lives, they matter.
I thought we were just talking about podcasts again.
Yeah, no. they shape us. However you encounter a story, if reading out loud, in a movie, anything like that. And of course, we can listen to stories without being shaped, especially stories which incarnate knowledge in ways we disagree with. I think this is why some stories resonate with us, while some just kind of fall flat, even if they're objectively well written. It's why we can say that we believe in a story, in a sense. Like, I don't believe that Narnia exists, but I do believe in Narnia, as it were, because I've assented to allowing Narnia to shape my understanding. But then there are other books I don't believe in that way, because I've encountered them and thought, I don't agree with this. Not that it isn't true, even, that it isn't ringing true. There's not the right words to discuss this, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And what I'm really saying is, even if I assent to all of the knowledge which this is attempting to pass to me, which might not be much if it's fiction, I do not assent to the way this is attempting to shape my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what I'm saying. But most of the time, we're not super intentional about this. It can be really easy to find yourself being shaped or having been shaped by stories which you might not, given more thought, approve of. So that's why we need to be careful about what we allow ourselves to engage with. But again, it's one of those things. As long as you're mindful, I don't think there's any, like, story that, like, ought not to be read or whatever, you know? Just stories that maybe ought not to be believed. Anyway, So mythology operates in a lot of ways, but I think primarily it operates as a story. Mythology constructs a shared language of images, which function as a sort of shared experience for everyone who hears them, and helps to incarnate the concepts it concerns itself with, be they the origins of the world or the nature of heroism. For the Greeks, heroism is understood to be something like what Hercules and Achilles did. Sometimes these images are so strong, they literally become part of language. You see this in Norse myth a lot. They have what's called kennings, which is like a nickname for something. So when I say Freya's tears, everyone knows that I'm talking about gold.
Whoa.
Because everyone understands gold and Freya's tears to be the same thing. They've got a ton of names for gold, by the way. Like, a million. When I say wolf friend, that means warrior, because those two things are tied together. That kind of stuff. But like I said, Greeks, you have the same thing. And this kind of gets into other parts of philosophy. Plato talks about this a little bit, about how a child can be taught heroism by the stories of Achilles and all that stuff. So you could call Achilles kind of the semi-Platonic ideal of heroism to the Greeks. But anyway, what mythology actually says about these things is, of course, very telling. Nestor, this kind of comes to what you said. Mythologies tell us about the worldview of the cultures which made them. Mm-hmm. Whether and like just like you said, one of the interesting things is whether the Greeks really believed these stories actually physically occurred almost doesn't matter. I think they probably, several of them did believe it, but whether they believed it or not, they were the type of people willing to tell these stories and shape their lives and shape their understanding with these stories.
Yeah,
they were the type of people who wanted to do that.
I think I had the story of Icarus in my head. I always think of the story of Icarus when I think about that.
Mm.
Because something that the Greeks really valued was not taking anything to an extreme.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
especially exactly. Under the moderation influence of Aristotle. And so you have the story of Icarus where he flew too low and then he flew too high. And the whole time his father is telling him, keep the middle course, my son, keep the middle course.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't and he died.
and whether or not the Greeks actually believed that there was a boy named Icarus who did die or not, they were the type of people who were willing to tell their children these stories.
And you can still use, I mean, even outside of Greek mythology, you could still use that image in the musical Hamilton.
You have married an Icarus, he is flying too close to the sun.
Yeah, so that's kind of what I wanted to talk about too. Is that this is continuing. Yeah, so I said earlier that stories help us transmit our understanding to others. And just like textbooks, the great thing about that is that that can last a really long time. So let me just back up one more time and talk about kind of what stories do for us and why they're important, and mythological stories especially. I said earlier that I think stories fulfill a basic need of human nature. And mythology, I think, does this more than most. I find mythologies particularly interesting because more than any other type of story, they come about because human beings are hungry for more than they see. There has to be more than what I interact with in everyday life. The fact that mythologies exist help us to cut to the core of human desire. And humans, I believe, have an innate drive to do a few things. Among these are to understand, to enjoy, to worship, and to create community. And we, intentionally or unintentionally, knowingly or not, base our lives around these things. And myths work to facilitate all of them. Some better than others. They help to explain the world and where it came from. They help shape our understanding. They help us enjoy the things around us. They point us to beings we may worship. And by shaping culture, shaping people, and creating this language of images, they help us create community too. And one of the great things about this is that myths still do this. At very least, they still create community. Even if the culture which was originally created, the culture of temples and sacrifices, is gone, the language remains. And I don't just mean Greek, but the language of images. And for Greek myth in particular, this has had an extremely lasting impact on other stories which we tell. Like you said, Hamilton references it. If you didn't know anything about Greek myth, Shakespeare would be even more hard to read than it already is. Greek myth is everywhere. We still use all of these images. And I, too, know the image language of Greek myth. I am literate in that language. Perhaps not the same way as a ancient priestess of Apollo might have been, but I still see and speak that language.
This is the part
that gets kind of personal for me. I want to get into kind of my personal reasons for doing this and why we're starting with Greek myth. I'm not trying to say that Greek myth is better than any other myths. I'm really not. I think there are a lot of really cool myths out there. Greek myth is the one that I know the best, and it's the one that I think has had the most lasting impact, at least in Western culture.
For sure.
Greek mythology was my bread and butter growing up. And what I mean by that is not that I'm an expert on Greek mythology, but that Greek mythology is and always has been so much a part of my consciousness and education, especially my early education, that I consistently forget that not everyone spit their childhood seeped in it. I subconsciously consider all of Greek mythology common knowledge, even when it's not.
She does.
I do, yeah.
Attest to that.
Mythology growing up was never an obsession of mine the same way that, like, the Lord of the Rings was. It wasn't a topic that I spent a lot of intentional time committed to. Instead, it was almost like a background knowledge, which I acquired so long ago that I honestly don't ever remember learning it or having a time where I didn't know about it. And strangely, because of this, I'm actually a lot more apt to get stuff wrong because I'm relying on this weird, almost innate knowledge instead of, like, actual memory and study. I learned the Greek gods, like, I learned colors and categories like that.
Mythology, instinctually.
Yeah, I know it sounds weird, but that's kind of how it feels.
I'm just naturally mythic.
But no, it is a language. It's something you have to learn to be literate in. I think all topics have this because all topics have vocabulary. But topics like mythology and stories, it's interesting because I think it can either be way easier or way harder to acquire the vocabulary because you have to spend time. You can't quickly acquire the vocabulary and feel the meaning. You have to live in this and sit in it and experience it for a bit. But it's also not nearly as technical as learning vocabulary for other topics like philosophy, which takes a lot of debate and reading and stuff. So yeah, I wanted to do this topic basically so that I could make sure that everyone here was on the same page as me, mythology knowledge-wise. And if I'm going to do a series on mythology, even though I've been spending a lot of time in Norse mythology recently, it feels only right to start with Greeks. So
I feel that.
I do want to give one more caveat kind of before, I know we're not going to transition today into the storytelling part, but I do just want to say this, in all this grand talk of mythology, I've made it seem really good, and I love it. I love Greek mythology, but there is a big difference between something being powerful and interesting and something being good. Greek myth, for all of its beauty, can be really, really ugly, and by ugly, I mean completely morally bereft. I don't ever want to fall prey to the fallacy that just because it's ancient means it's right or permissible, just because it's lasted this long. A lot of bad stuff is going to happen in the stories that I'm going to tell you guys, and I still don't really understand how a culture could celebrate some of these beings as gods. Like, there are much better gods out there. For real. It's actually
shop
really...
around a little bit, guys.
Yeah, it's really interesting to see the Greek philosophers who realize this kind of try to squirm and deal with it. Like, there's a reason they executed Socrates for impiety and corrupting the youth. But, yeah, just because I've praised mythology as a thing which exists and which I enjoy doesn't mean I want to praise any particular myths for being good or shaping our understanding in a good way. Just because it helped the Greeks understand the world, and I appreciate that, doesn't mean that we should understand the world. That basically, there's going to be a lot of rape and death and other terrible injustices in these stories, and some incest and a really shocking amount of zoophilia thrown in. But ew. Mostly, yeah, I just wanted to warn y'all in case you didn't know. I think you
and
guys
that last
both do,
one
but
is
warn our listeners.
Gonna all come from Zeus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is a truly terrible amount of rape in these stories, and a lot of it will be thrown in almost casually or even like it's a good thing. Obviously, I don't support this, but they're not my stories. So I just wanted to get that out there.
When we get to that episode, we'll definitely include
that
ones.
Episode. All of the episodes. There,
all of them.
There are very few stories that don't involve that.
I meant appropriate warnings on appropriate episodes. Yeah. It's not yeah, like here sure. on out, this is going to be a nasty, nasty podcast.
For sure. But yeah, I just kind of wanted to say that before we got any further with all this.
I'm glad you did.
Yeah. I think next time, I've been debating how to do it because I know you guys know some stuff about Greek mythology. I don't know where our listeners are at, but it might be kind of like a bit of a I ask questions and you say if you know that story or not, because like I said, I kind of classify all of it as common knowledge and I haven't really been able to convince myself that it's not.
It's going to be interesting for me because I think that a lot of my knowledge of Greek mythology does not come directly from Greek mythology. Like, we've talked about this before, Arissa, you grew up mm-hmm. reading books of Greek myths and Greek gods and all those things.
Yeah.
I did not. I grew up reading Narnia.
Mm-hmm.
Which, obviously, because Lewis really loved the Greek philosophers and the Greek myths, he incorporated a lot of those things in there.
Especially in Prince Caspian.
In Prince Caspian, but really throughout all of them, the Silver Chair is basically an ode to Plato's cave.
Is it?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, so is the Dawn Treader. There's a lot there.
You really like Plato there, don't you, Clive?
Oh, he loves
Plato. It's all
Plato.
In Plato. What do they teach in schools these days?
but no, the first time that I think I really encountered anything remotely close to Greek philosophy and mythology was in high school, and it was basically just in my textbook that was kind of a brief. Here are some basic things, and here are some basic ideas. But even in that moment, the minute I read, here's a basic overview of Plato's theology, I was like, I know that.
And that's that feeling. Yes, that's so what first got me talking about this idea that stories incarnate these types of things was a bit from Lewis, which is actually about how he talks about nature. He says that I would not understand that God was magnificent if I had not seen certain mountain ranges. Mm-hmm. And I kind of translated it as also story because I grew up reading the Chronicles of Narnia. And when I got to high school and started reading Plato, it was like, I know this taste. I've never read this book before, but I know this feeling. I know how this smells. I have encountered this before.
So you're saying it's familiar, but not too familiar.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But very good. Not too familiar.
Yeah. Rowan Williams actually writes that this was Lewis's intention with Aslan, that when someone who was not a Christian and had not encountered Christianity or Christ before, if they were to read the Chronicles of Narnia, by the time that they met Christ, they would already know him.
Lewis wrote that was Lewis's intention in Narnia.
Oh, good.
At the end of the Dawn Treader, that is why you were brought to Narnia, so that by knowing me here for a while, you might know me better there.
Yes, exactly.
This is going to degenerate into me quoting the Chronicles of Narnia.
I mean, they are, in a sense, a mythology. I think Lewis and Tolkien both wrote mythologies, and how Tolkien did it was to make his documents feel like the ancient documents that he read academically. I've always said that The Lord of the Rings is a history book that just so happens to be fictitious. because when you compare its style to the style of the ancient epics we have, it fits. It works super well. But what Lewis did, I think, was almost more powerful because he wrote a mythology that functioned in the same way that Greek mythology did, which was as a story you told to children to educate them about the world. And how Narnia works is extremely similar to the way the Greek mythology works. It generated a language of images and a language of feelings and tastes and smells, if you don't mind the metaphor, that when you later encounter things that are claiming knowledge, like Plato's metaphysics or Christian theology, you already understand those things. You now have the words. I think a lot of things, people want to teach the words and then the meaning, but in experience, it's usually almost better to teach the meaning and then the words. But both of them are really important, because if we just teach meaning and not words, we cannot communicate or understand our lives. But if we just teach words and not meaning, that's just terribly sad.
This is all really fascinating to me, just because aside from, I think, two works of fiction, one of which is Narnia, the stories that I read growing up that served that purpose in my life were historical fiction.
Yeah. A lot of mine were fan fiction, not gonna lie.
So for me, the way I interact with history is the way I hear a lot of people talking about how they interact with myth.
Interesting.
It works that way in my head, but also in my heart. It's never been... I hear so many people say, well, I don't like to study history because it's all just a bunch of dates and names and who cares. But my earliest interaction with it was in the form of pure story.
Yeah.
And so to me, it was always very real.
I think that's, yeah, really important that the way we tell these stories and whether we are trying to transmit knowledge or transmit understanding is really important because that can, that works so differently. And like I said, you need both, but.
It was always a literal way of understanding the world. It was never just know these five kings and these four presidents. It was, no, we're literally understanding the world and it's creating this shared experience between you and between everyone else who knows these stories, but also between very real people in the past. I think there's a quote by Seneca that says, you could choose to just stay in your time, but why would you do that when you could travel all of space and time and interact with all these people? And for me, that's always literally what it was. And so I just think it's funny that the way you talk about mythology is the way I talk about encountering Eleanor of Aquitaine for the first time, or sitting in class, and we go through and we parse all the elements of this culture, and you get to the very bottom because it's all so foreign to us now, but you get to the very bottom of it, what you see as a human being.
Yeah, no, I think that's really true. My encounter of Joan of Arc, of Alexander Hamilton, it's, to borrow words, really important who tells your story.
Yeah, and how they tell the story.
This is defining something that I've always tried to do in my writing, which part of my brain wants to say, well, I only write true stories, but like, not like literally true.
Yeah.
Like, but this is what I mean, is I want to transmit an understanding of something that is real and true and righteous and beautiful.
Like I said, I think the language needs developing, but I think what you're saying is really good words for it.
Yeah.
The difference between true and ringing true.
Actual. Yeah, exactly. So I'm never going to tell a story that I think has an unhappy ending, for example, because I don't, there's something about that on a cosmic level that does not ring true to me.
I've heard a lot of people talk that way. Some of them more in the vein of, like, if it's not happy, I don't want to waste my own time on it because my life is unhappy. And I would rather fill my time with happier things. But I think what you're saying is different.
Yeah, it's not a matter of escapism. It's more like, I believe that ultimately there will be a happy ending. Mm-hmm. And to portray anything but that, and, you know, there's the bittersweet ending. There are tragedies that happen, but to portray anything less than the happy end of a story is belying the nature of the universe on some level.
It's interesting. I feel like I felt that way for a long time, and it's taken me a long time to come around to tragedies. I feel like tragedies can be well done.
Oh, no. I'm not saying that I don't like tragedies, because I love a good tragedy, honestly. But I'm saying that the way that I write, I cannot... I couldn't them. Write a tragedy. Okay. I could not communicate that because it is not my understanding and it's not the understanding I want to give.
That's really interesting. Yeah, I've thought about... It's only been really recently I've started thinking about this in my own writing. I don't write a lot of fiction, first of all. But even in this like D&D campaign I'm writing, I'm thinking about like what am I communicating through this story? And it's interesting, I'm not 1,000% behind the message which I would interpret if I encountered someone else writing the same story I did. And I've been trying to fix it, but because I'm working within the sphere of Norse mythology and trying to constrain myself by that, I have to work in their reality, not in mine.
It's a different story. Oh, yeah. That's so interesting! Oh, I love it!
I just thought of something. If I could give you guys a little homework... You don't have to bring it back. You do not have to bring it back for next week. Okay. This isn't that kind of homework. This isn't homework you turn in. This is just food for thought homework. Go and find your favorite fictions, your favorite fictional characters, and think about what did they shape your understanding of. I was just looking over at my wall, and I saw a poster for Wonder Woman, and thought how my understanding of justice and courage and confidence changed when I encountered Wonder Woman. and that kind of thing. So, like I said, you don't have to turn it in. I'm not going to be collecting this homework.
I'm excited because I'm in a chat group and someone had posted something, it's like yesterday or the day before, that said, hey, define yourself with a collage of 3 fictional characters. And I ended up with 4 that I thought had been most influential in shaping some of my thought processes. So I'm halfway done.
They don't have to be characters. They don't have to be characters that you see yourself in either. They can just be things that incarnate the way that you see the world in general.
Honestly, I'm really glad that they don't have to be characters that you see yourself in, because I have 2 of those?
Yeah, I have several of those, but then I have other characters. Like, I don't see myself in Aslan. Like, I'm not gonna say that.
But the point of Aslan is to not, actually.
Exactly. But the existence of that character and that story has profoundly shaped the way I see the world. I think we want to kind of conclude with that. A bit of a call to action, as it were. Look at the stories that you, dear listener, believe in some deep way that passes knowledge and touches understanding. And ask yourself, what if my understanding of my belief about the world has been shaped by this story? Sometimes you might even find things that you want to correct. You want to say, no, maybe that's wrong. Maybe I can fix it. And again, I mentioned this way back when I did that episode on parasocial relationships. Look at the stories you are encountering and you are allowing to shape you. And especially look at their authors. And look for what's missing. Because if your understanding is only being shaped by white men, that might be an issue. And I say that about to launch into a big, long colloquium series about stories written by white men. But I think it's something to keep in mind.
Oh, listener, you know what you should do after you come up with these characters? You should send them to us in an email at theliberalarts@gmail.com. I am betting that we can find some time to read your emails on air, and we'd love to do that. So,
yes. Or if you don't want them read on air, we will at least write an email back to you.
Yeah, maybe specify if you don't. Hey, Cleo, do you have a postgrad problem for us?
I do. First of all, general problem is just that the seasons are changing, and since I am allergic to the seasons changing...
Right.
And we're getting the first bands of rain from Hurricane Florence coming through. My allergies just hate me, and it's kind of miserable.
Right.
I'm so sorry.
That's no fun. Which is adding an extra layer of no fun to something that I really want to complain about.
Okay.
Which is my textbook.
All right. Bring it on. What's wrong with your freaking textbook?
My Greek textbook.
Oh, no. Which one is it?
It's called Greek to Me. It's written by a man named Story.
Oh, yeah, I have the sequel to that book. It's still Greek to Me.
Yeah, it's... I do not doubt that for some people out there with particular learning styles, this is a good method of learning a language. Particularly if those people are under the age of 12.
Oh,
shade. Things are heating up here in Greek class.
But I really find it distracting. Instead of just learning how to parse verbs, I am supposed to learn it via a picture of a woman named Vera Verb.
Oh, Lord.
And, you know, I remember person, you know, tense voice, person, mood, number... by remembering what Vera Verb was wearing. And her moo-moo dress signifies her good mood.
Wow.
I was hoping you'd say it was like Familia Romana, but just for Greek. Romana is a Latin learning textbook that does not have any English in it. It's all in Latin, and it's like the way you learn English. See Bob Run, that kind of stuff, but in Latin.
No, I could deal with that.
So it's not that at all.
That's partially like how mnemonics. I learned. No, that's partially how I learned Lithuanian. But yeah, it's a lot of word association and a lot of pictures and word association. So basically, like, we're doing verbs this week, or nouns. And so to remember the parts of a noun, I'm supposed to not only remember, what is it? Number
person, number
case, but I have to remember the little comics that go with each case. Oh my gosh, you know? So for the genitive case, instead of just remembering the genitive case is possessive, I have to remember a picture of Gerald and Geraldine holding a giant heart because they're Gerald and Geraldine genitive and they're in
love.
This
is the worst.
And so what this has come down to is that I'm reading the actual grammar sections of the texts, which are about a third of the text, and I'm skipping everything else.
Oh my god.
Yeah, remind me what level of education you are currently pursuing.
Graduate school.
Yeah. Whose idea was this?
I love that we just finished talking about how you can use stories to transmit understanding, and this is like... How not to do it.
How not to do it, 101. Oh, it is driving me insane.
It's like they read one book on mnemonics and they're like, we could make a religion out of this.
Yeah, basically. And
we could make an education out of this.
This is Greek. I am not a linguist, but Greek is the fifth language I have studied in some way.
Holy crap.
And this is not at all how I learn languages.
Wait. English, Spanish, Lithuanian, what else?
Yeah. I mean, English, Spanish.
American Sign Language?
Arabic.
Oh, Arabic! I forgot Arabic.
Lithuanian. Okay, and, I mean, this is my second go-around on Greek. And Welsh.
Oh, and Welsh?
We did Welsh.
Yeah. Holy crap!
Nestor and I both did Welsh for, like, one semester.
I do still have my Greek textbook, my other Greek textbook that we used in class together, and I'm trying to pull it out of my stack of books right now. I mean, the fact that I've done Greek before and the fact that I've taken Lithuanian, which is pretty similar to Greek grammatically, is helping a lot. I was going to say,
Lithuania and Greece are not close.
Grammatically, though, they're very similar. They have a lot of the same cases. You have to decline nouns and parse the verbs and all of that stuff.
So mostly it's just that English is dumb and follows none of the rules that most languages do.
Yes.
That's true.
Yes.
I was trying to teach some kids the, pronoun charts and tried to teach them about, like, cases. About, you know, like, a couple English words still have cases. I can't think of them now, of course. They were pronouns, so it was things like,
he does, she does, I do.
No, but words like whom, who and whom.
Yeah.
Are cases. Mm. And they were just like, what? So I was trying to go through how many cases English had, and it was like, we don't have this one, we don't have that one, we don't have the other one, we don't,
I think I and me would technically fill the case because one is the subject and one is the direct object.
Yeah, so how I walked them through it eventually was just narrowing it down to subject-object.
Yeah.
But it was just like, but if you were in any other language, there are like five more.
I mean, Lithuanian by itself, I think every word has at least 13 forms.
Woof! Oh my gosh.
With all the cases and everything.
That's many.
Yeah. But it's just, the way this textbook is set up is not very intuitive for how you speak a language, or even how you learn a language. Most people don't learn language by word association, they learn it by going ball.
Well, it
duck.
Just feels like
that's not how you teach, that's
not- learning is great for taking tests.
Oh.
Yeah.
Hooray.
But that's not how you teach a baby to speak, you don't read a book about farm animals with a baby and go, what is that, Johnny? That's a duck. And duck rhymes with truck. And if you hit a duck with a truck, it'll die. So that's how you can remember duck.
I mean, maybe you don't, but my dad definitely said things like that.
T, and that rhymes with P, and that stands for pool.
Yeah, exactly. That is how we are learning Greek right now. And it is driving me up the wall. This week our chapter is on nouns, and we've already done vera verb. In the intro to this chapter, it'll say, like, in this lesson, you're gonna meet the noun clown.
No.
And I'm like, first of all, I don't want to meet anyone else in this book. Second of all, I definitely do not want to meet a clown. And then you flip the page, and here's this clown with big giant teeth carrying a briefcase. So we were supposed to remember gender, number, and case, right? God. And the way remember gender is we look at the clown, and he has big giant teeth that grind. So think grinder, gender.
What?
Yes, I'm not making
you couldn't have just been like, it's a man.
It is the most traumatic, you know, I'm supposed to remember how to do nouns in Greek with a giant tooth clown. It's not okay.
That's terrifying. Jaws that bite and claws that snatch. Sorry.
Exactly.
You know what really would have been a better reminder of gender for noun clown?
Gender.
Would be if you made noun clown a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How old is this bird?
I'm just waiting for the Jub-Jub bird to come into this.
I don't know.
And the Bandersnatch.
Apparently, this has been going on for a while, and it's kind of popular. Like, he has an entire website dedicated to this method of learning, and people pay money to do it. So I guess there are people out there that this helps. But because my experience with learning language has been with spoken language, with language that you actually use. Mm-hmm. That's how I've always learned languages, by just using them and learning the words and learning the verb endings and slowly starting to take them apart and put them back together for myself, like you do when you're learning to talk. Mm-hmm. And so it's just, I'm really honestly just complaining because what I've done, like I said, I underline the parts that are actually grammar and skip the rest.
This kind of goes back to the colloquium, though, because you learn best by experience, right?
Yeah.
And they're trying to transmit these experiences that have no grounding or basis in reality.
Yes.
And are honestly kind of, like, patronizing.
And it's adding, for me at least, it's adding another layer of translation. Instead of just looking, instead of just looking at the Greek word book and thinking biblion book means book, I have to apparently look at it and go, biblion means book. And I have to take apart the noun clown to remember what case this book is currently in. And remember Gerald and Geraldine genitive, if it is in the genitive case, so they're in love, so I can remember that the genitive case is possessive.
Well, what's bad is that in is actually dative, so.
Yeah.
What?
I know. Yeah. But, yeah, I know.
No, that's
It's just,
I feel like the experience I learned by was the experience of walking down a hallway chanting as an uo and uno noise, that kind of crap, you know?
Yeah. So that's basically what I'm doing. I'm taking the small grammar sections out of the book, I'm underlining them all, reading them, and doing what they told me not to do, which is to write out the endings, the verb endings, and the noun.
They told you not to do
that?
They
told you not to do that?
Yeah, apparently this
method, the best
experience
is to write and rewrite and rewrite.
I know. Apparently this method is supposed to help you learn in a way that's better than rote memorization.
Wrong.
It's not working, so I'm basically just writing them all down. I've made flashcards, I chant them.
It's trying to avoid memorization, but it's using tricks invented by people who have, like, this is what people do, people with, like, insanely good memories, this is exactly what they do. They create mind palaces and images with word association. These are memorizing tricks.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I know.
I'm furious on your behalf.
Wow.
I'm gonna learn Greek despite all this, but it's just frustrating. And
I hope
honestly,
you end up the best student in the class, and the professor, who I believe we've talked about him, but not on the show. He's not a great professor.
Well,
will go to you and say, wow, Cleo, you're the best student I've ever had in this class. How did you do it? And you can tell him, well, you see, I tossed your textbook into a garbage fire.
No thanks to you.
I literally did everything this textbook said not to do. And voila.
Oh my gosh.
But, and then I start to feel bad because I'm like, I'm not a linguist. These people have been teaching Greek for years. It's apparently worked for some people. Who am I to say this is dumb? But at the same time, I've also been learning languages for years. I teach a language right now. And I can tell you, if I ever tried to teach English to my students that way, I'd have a riot. Yeah. They'd be like, what?
Your adult students, you know, like the adults you're going to grad school with, would be like, this is patronizing and dumb, Cleo.
Yeah, they would. And I would not blame
them. Stop it!
Because I read the words meet the noun clown and I was like, I'm sorry. I did that in kindergarten.
More like beat the noun clown.
I did that in kindergarten and we're not going back there. Actually, I don't think I even did that in kindergarten because I could read by the time I got to kindergarten.
Jeez Louise.
So yeah, that's just me complaining.
So what are you into this week?
I have three things that I'm into.
Oh, wow. Well, that's good because I have zero.
Okay, good.
Do you want to pick one and save the others for later, or?
Nope.
That's not how she operates, and you know it. We will be inundated with love, and we will like it.
Yes. So the first thing I'm into is just food.
Cheers, mate.
I hate chicken salad, and I have discovered a recipe for chicken salad that I love.
Wow. That's always fun.
Yes, I know. It's a miracle.
That happened to me with shrimp and grits a while back. My mom made some that I was like, but these are good, though.
I know.
How have you done this?
I know. I was eating it at someone's house to be polite, and I took one bite and was like, what is this? But it's really good. I could share the recipe on Instagram if anyone wants to try the best chicken salad.
Yeah, we'll put it up on the website. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so I made a big pot of that, and I'm going to eat it for the next couple days because I love it. I'm into the fact that I bought season tickets for my local theater's Broadway run this year.
Yes.
Nice. And my first show is Saturday. Super excited. School of Rock.
Yay!
And the last thing I'm into is Netflix original movies.
Oh no, okay.
Well, I think we talked about To All the Boys I've Loved Before. Did we talk about that one?
Did we talk about that one?
I don't know.
I do love it, though. I did see it.
It was shockingly good. I was expecting
it's so cute
to be horrified. I turned it on to basically have something to laugh at and ended up actually liking it. So now I'm watching Sierra Burgess as a Loser. And
I've heard good things about that one, too.
I'm actually enjoying that one, too. So, Netflix,
I've never heard of this.
Go the Netflix. Rom-coms. Yes.
That's probably why I haven't heard of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, so way to go, Netflix, for getting me to watch
things. Oh, now I'm just thinking about how rom-coms influence your understanding of things. Because my mom watches a lot of Hallmark movies.
I love Hallmark movies.
They can be good.
You enjoy laughing at Hallmark movies. Some people absorb them.
I enjoy calling out tropes. And that I will sit with my mom and watch a Hallmark movie and spend the whole thing predicting what is about to happen and being right.
I will do that with regular Hallmark movies when it comes to the Christmas ones. Any sort of sappy Christmas movie where someone gets stuck in a small town and Santa Claus shows up and so there's a reindeer missing, all of them, Hallmark or not, I love them. I don't laugh at them. I sit and cry over them.
Literally anything with the word Christmas in it is like yep. that for you, though, Cleo.
Yep. If it's Christmas, it is real. And it should be treated as a high form of art. And Elf is amazing. And
you ever heard the song, I'm Getting Nothing for Christmas?
Yes, I love it.
Is that a high form of art?
It is beautiful.
Okay. Let's just move on before I have to respond to that. Let's
wrap up, shall we?
I thought of something I wanted to mention before we close.
Please do.
It's not really something I'm into, and that it's just something I wanted to share with y'all. It's something I've been seeing for a while now, because there are several posters that are up in the school I work at that have a picture of Wonder Woman on them. And they're very poorly done in that the graphics are bad. But the words say something that I keep trying to figure out how I feel about what it's saying. It says, Wonder Woman is not a fictional character. Wonder Woman is a state of mind.
I don't.
And I'm like, on one hand, you're objectively false, but I kind of like what you're going for here. And my colloquium today made me think about that.
I like That's it. Beautiful. Wonder Woman is a state of mind. It's kind of like always be yourself unless you can be Batman.
Can be Batman?
Mm-hmm.
Then be Batman. Except that Wonder Woman is significantly better than Batman, especially the current iteration of him. We can't talk about the new Batman or I will never stop. I hate him so much. Anyway.
Shade. So if you, listener, would like to tell us who you would like to live in a state of mind of, despite the fact that they are objectively not real, or you just want to tell us about the fictional characters that have shaped your understanding of the world, please email us at theliberalarts@gmail.com.
Gosh.
Also, you should check out last week's episode with Jared Anderson. He was our special guest, talked about publishing fiction and the nature of literature, which I thought was interesting that we ended up talking about that. Yeah, so thank you to Tristan from Vintage Lab Tech for our music, to Caitlin Thompson for our graphics, and to JD, our loyal listener JD, who suggested this week's opening. You can suggest those in our email as well.
Yeah, I just want to say again, thank you guys for listening. Thank you for allowing the stories we share to help shape your understanding of things. It's a real, I think, honor to be a storyteller, and that's what a lot of our colloquiums end up being. So thanks for listening. And until next time, learn something worth knowing.